Chapter 3. The Boss. He sat there, a thin man with his face seemingly set in a permanent scowl. But it was not a scowl. It was just the way his face set when he was relaxed. And he always was. But his desk was a blaze of dazzling light from a spotlight set in the ceiling. It hurt my eyes to look at him. And that light in the ceiling grew brighter and brighter as his eyesight dimmed until he was, in the end, entirely blind. Then the spotlight was turned off. It was no longer needed. His eyesight began to dim when he was in high school, and for that reason, he always sat in the front row in school. Then, years later, when I was working for him and we were on a trip, as we often were, he always wanted to go to a movie instead of a nightclub. And I, of course, went with him. And we sat in the front row, with actors and actresses on the screen walking back and forth across that giant screen, making me turn my head to follow the action. And then, some years later, he was entirely blind, and I would take him to lunch at Duluth's exclusive club, the Gitche Gammy Club, there on London Road. And he would hold on to my sleeve as we got out of the car and walked in the close-by rear door into the club. Then we would always sit in the same corner, way over there on one side of the room, away from everyone else, a table always reserved for him. It was then I was aware of how much his hearing had sharpened as his eyes grew dimmer. Sitting there, he would tell me who else was in the room, judging only by the voices that drifted our way. And it was a few years later that his heart ceased beating, sitting there alone in a hospital bed, alone in the darkness that had been his constant companion for years past. What a tragic way for a great man to leave this earth, to leave as a whimper and not as a shout. We like to think of great men going down with arms flailing and sword flashing, but this great man slid from darkness to greater darkness and was gone to us forever. I call him great, but few people did. Not because he was not great, because he was, but because so few people knew him. He was a quiet, private sort of man, hidden away from the world, yet he was a giant in his part of the newspaper, radio, television world. Even in that part of the world, he was largely unknown. Only a few of us knew him, and we knew him well. His office was buried in the middle of the Evening Telegram newspaper building there at 13th and Tower Avenue in downtown Superior, Wisconsin. Even if you looked for his office, you would not find it. And if by chance you did, you would not be asked in. He went to and from his office through a short fire escape leading to a little-used corridor in his office. You could easily work for him for years in the newspaper there and never once see him. It was not that he did not like people. It was just that he was not one to stand on street corners or in offices or stores and gossip about the time of day. He had his business, his home, and his family, and that was his world. His home was a beautiful mansion sort of place out there on the St. Louis River, close by to the city of Superior city limits. There was a brick wall all around with iron gates. The home gave him a place where he felt safe and secure, as it should. He had a 30-foot yacht on which he would venture out in the river and out to the Duluth Superior Bay, and maybe even into Lake Superior, cautiously, of course. Aboard would be his family, and if there were others, they would be publishers of his newspapers, and possibly also managers of his radio and TV stations, although those two were rather low on his priority list. He was primarily a newspaper man, and the odors of printer's ink was ever in his nostrils. His radio and TV stations made money, but other than that, he saw little use for them. I first met him right after his father had died, and he settled down in his father's office. It was right about then that Leslie Ross sold station WEBC to Morgan, and of course I went with the station. I was a little awed by this quiet man. Broadcasters are inclined to be a bit noisy and flamboyant, and that was the life I knew. Now, there was something new in my world, and I sat back to measure it. His name, of course, was Morgan Murphy, but I always called him Morgan. And even here we have a little mystery. At this late day, long after his death, I've suddenly come to realize my calling his Morgan was a bit unusual, as most everyone else called him Mr. Murphy, even those close to him, and high in his organization. Being a man of great dignity, he must have wanted everyone to call him Mr., but he did allow a few, very few, of us to call him Morgan. And so it was, for all those years, I knew him, and in the end, I, as a pallbearer at his funeral, looked down on his quiet face, and for the last time said, "Goodbye, Morgan," while others in the funeral home were tiptoeing around the room and referring to him as Mr. Murphy. At first, he did not pay much attention to WBBC, but then he noticed the station was making money, even though the nation was going through the Great Depression. That caught his eye, and he wondered if one radio station made money, possibly more radio stations would make even more money. His gaze went 60 miles north, to Hibbing and Virginia, Minnesota, where he also owned newspapers, and presently I was commissioned to establish radio stations in those two towns. One went on the air in October 1935, and the other a year later. The fact that these two radio stations would be competing directly for the advertising dollar with his own newspaper in the two towns did not disturb him. Gently but firmly, he told his newspaper people to meet the new radio competition as best they could, and they did. It was not in his plan to put a soft cushion under his newspaper people. The struggle would make better people of them. Of course, if he had not put radio stations in those towns, someone else would have. And it's better to own the competition than to fight it. He explained this to me in his office one day after I had quizzically put the question to him. I never brought it up again. Then later, he decided to put a radio station in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and again in Madison, Wisconsin, where he had no newspapers at all. But by that time, his radio stations were making money and were commanding more and more of his attention. Later, he put TV stations in Eau Claire and Madison, Wisconsin, and Spokane, Washington, and they so overshadowed the radio stations he lost interest in radio stations and was selling them off. But by that time, I had left his organization and no longer cared. He ran his empire through a small circle of executives. They surrounded him and protected him from direct contact with those he did business with. It was not that he did not want to meet people, but he considered it a waste of his time to discuss business propositions with people all day long. Let his executives do that, who would bring to him only a quick summary of each transaction. To do business with Morgan Murphy, you would contact whichever of his executives who were involved in that part of the Murphy Empire. If it was radio you wanted to discuss, you would contact Walter Bridges or myself. If it was newspaper, you talked to Max Levine or Clo Gates. If it was general financing, you talked to Norman Postles or Leslie Olson. Of course, there was some crossing over in the duties of the executives, as we all know much of what was going on in all divisions. Sitting at the foot of the throne as I did all those years, I knew a great deal of what was going on within the Murphy Empire. So did all the executives, but the world out there learned nothing from us. One time, an exasperated party remarked that Murphy has men who have ears, but no mouths. You would discuss your deal with one of us, and we would then go in and talk to Morgan. Then we would come back and talk to you. This back and forth negotiating would go on until all was resolved. This gave Morgan time to thoroughly think out the problem, and also possibly whittle you down a bit. He did drive hard bargains, but never once did I ever detect anything other than complete honesty in his dealings. Of course, there might be an individual who would claim foul in a business dealing with Morgan, but actually they would only be revealing their own inability to negotiate. And in Superior, one could meet any number of people who claim Morgan was the one person responsible for the fact that Superior never was as great big as Duluth, just across the bay. Morgan Murphy was holding the town back, everyone said. This strains the imagination more than a little. I have no idea how Morgan Murphy could hold a town back, and it strains the imagination even more, wondering why he should want to. The more Superior grew and prospered, the more his newspaper and radio station, WBC, would prosper. Morgan never was adverse to prosperity. When Morgan's flamboyant father died, there was considerable skepticism among the newspaper people in the Murphy Empire regarding the ability of this quiet, almost unknown man to lead the empire. He had been among them learning the business, working in each department, but he made no waves and left no impression. Ask a newspaper employee those days what they thought of Morgan Murphy, and they likely would answer, "Morgan who?" even though they might have worked alongside him for a short stretch. Max Levine, manager of Morgan's Superior Evening Telegram newspaper in Superior, Wisconsin, told me of Morgan's first day in the office after his father's funeral. Max and I were having dinner in a restaurant in St. Cloud, Minnesota, that evening. I had just built Max's new radio station, WJON, in St. Cloud, and we were musing over many things, and Max remembered Morgan's first day. Morgan permitted his employees to have other businesses if they wanted, if that other business did not interfere with their first loyalty, which was to Morgan, and everyone made sure this rule was observed. That first day Morgan sat down at his father's desk, he called Max in. When Max walked in, he stood in front of Morgan's desk, and Morgan said, "What are they saying?" Max said, "They say you can't do it." Morgan said, "I can." And that was the end of the conversation. This was a typical Morgan Murphy conversation, short and to the point with no wasted words. Max walked out of the room and went downstairs to his desk and waited to see if Morgan could do it. He could, and he did. Morgan's conversations were always short, and you'd better listen carefully. He was not going to repeat or elaborate. I learned to do this and learned it well, and that is why I remained with him over 25 years, and why, after I left, he came and asked me to come back. Others fell by the wayside and were gone from the Murphy organization. Sometimes, he would tell a story. It was not that he was a storyteller, as he definitely was not, but in each story was a message for you, and you had better listen very carefully and dig out that message. I could, and did. They tell me there was a politician from Illinois who did the same thing, that is, told stories with a message. If I remember my fourth grade history correctly, that man was Abraham Lincoln, and he sat in the White House during some very trying years in our country's history. He was called President Lincoln then, and still is. Morgan was a devoted family man. He and wife Elizabeth raised son John and daughter Elizabeth, gently and with a firm hand. I've lost track of them these past many years, but I do know John is running the newspaper part of the Murphy Empire, and Elizabeth is overlooking the television part of the empire. Obviously, they received the same stern upbringing Morgan himself received from his father, and are expertly running their portions of the empire, defying the general rule that great fortunes never last beyond the second generation. Morgan traveled east several times each year, mostly to New York or Washington, and almost always on newspaper business. He might concern himself with broadcasting business briefly, but mostly he left that to Walter Bridges and myself. Being a family man, very often his family traveled with him, but if they were not able to, one of his executives would go with him, the executive closest to the matter involved on the trip. But he never went alone. Always someone was with him, and this was because of his failing eyesight. I went with him many times, and each trip was a joy, as we always stayed at the best hotels and ate in the best restaurants. Morgan always went first class, and we executives did not mind that at all. No hotel suites, just nice rooms, no nightclubs, but maybe movies, stage plays, or opera. And we who went with him always paid the bills as we moved along. He did not put his hand in his pocket. Of course, Secretary Lois Westman back home would always buy his train or airplane ticket, but beyond that, it was up to us men. At the end of the trip, we would turn in an expense account, which was always paid without question. We could have padded those expenses, I suppose, but we never did. That would be an unthinkable breach of faith. Before the war, we always went by train. After the war, it was a toss-up, train or airplane. On trains, Morgan would have his room in the Pullman car, with or without family, and I would have another room on the same or next car. One such trip, he and his family were in a room a couple of cars ahead, and he asked his Pullman porter to find me. This man went from room to room asking if the occupant were Charlie Persons, and eventually he came to my room. I opened the door and admitted I was the one and only Charlie Persons. The porter noticed I was sitting there with a Bible across my lap. Morgan later told me this porter came back to his room, beaming, and saying, "Yes, sir, I did find Mr. Persons, and he is a very fine man." Morgan thought this was very interesting and repeated the story from time to time. After we had gotten on the train and I had settled down in a chair in the chair car, Morgan would proceed to walk the full length of the train, inspecting every car and every passenger. He had an insatiable interest in people. After such inspection, he would come back to me in the chair car and tell me what he had seen. Sometimes he would sit in a chair in the chair car and pretend to be reading a newspaper, but all the while he would be leaning back and listening to the conversations of the people in nearby chairs. Afterward, he would come and tell me what he had heard. He was not in the least nosy, as he never knew the people he had been listening to. He was only interested in what people said to each other when they talked. After the war, when we were flying, I became very adept at finding the gate which would be opened first for passenger boarding and in being the first in line at that gate. When the gate opened, I would rush ahead and get that special seat, the one Morgan insisted on. It was the seat by the emergency door over the wing. Morgan wanted a quick exit in case the plane crashed or caught on fire. After I had seated myself, Morgan would come wandering in and sit down beside me. Always he would say, "That was nice of you, Charlie. Thanks for getting this seat." And I might throw in here, he was always grateful for little things we did for him and so often thanked us for doing those things. I always knew when we were going to leave Duluth, as our railroad or plane tickets had a date on them. But I never knew when we were going back home. The usual way Morgan had of deciding when to return was to meet me for lunch, and in the course of the meal he would say, "We'll go back this afternoon." Immediately after the meal, I would rush to the ticket office and frantically try to get rooms or seats of trains or planes leaving later in the afternoon. Right after the war, this was not too difficult, but as the years went past and our country became more prosperous and more businessmen traveled, it became increasingly difficult to get accommodations on such short notice. A couple of times, I remember, the ticket agent said there were just no rooms on that train. Then he would notice a $20 bill, that's when the dollar was way uptown, sticking out between the fingers of my hand, and he would say that he would have another look. A bit later, he would come back and say he just found out that there had been a cancellation, and here are your tickets. So, if you had had a reservation at that ticket office and you came to pick it up and found there had been a terrible mix-up and there was no ticket for you, it could be that Charlie Persons had been there just ahead of you with a $20 bill in his hand. But I never went back to Morgan saying I could not get a room or seat. I don't know what would have happened if I had. I was very careful never to find out. When Morgan told me to do something, he dismissed it as having been done. Sometimes he would call me at my office and tell me to do something which I knew was impossible. But as we talked, I would hear a strange distant voice saying, "I'll take care of that, Morgan." That strange voice was mine, and after we hung up, I would sit there wondering if I should clear out my desk now or wait until he told me to. Morgan did not keep employees around who could not get things done. After a bit, I would call one or more of the other executives and tell them of my new problem, and somehow a solution would be found. We Murphy executives closed ranks and banded together when one of us was threatened with losing his job. Happily, Morgan never insisted on strict, detailed execution of his wishes, and a reasonably well-done job satisfied him. Maybe he intentionally pushed us to the brink. I never found out. But the system did work, and the Murphy Empire grew and grew. One time we were leaving a Washington hotel, and as he and I got in a cab to take us to the train depot, he handed me a blank Western Union Telegraph form. He said, "I found this in my room," and said nothing more. I put the form in my pocket and said nothing. You never asked Morgan questions. If there was something you were supposed to know, he would tell you. But you did not question him, and you took it from there. When we were back in Duluth, I took the Western Union form out and held it up to the light this way and that, and there I saw a faint indentation from someone writing a telegram on the form just above. Whoever wrote that telegram was merely wiring ahead for a room in a hotel in the next town. After I deciphered that, I picked up the phone, called Morgan, and read off the telegram. He only said, "Thanks," and hung up. I was only functioning in the Morgan Murphy manner, and I kept my job. The phone rang in my office one afternoon. It was Morgan calling to tell me something. He did this sort of thing. If he had something on his mind, he would call one of his executives and get it off his mind. After having done that, he would hang up and forget the whole thing. It was kind of a Russian roulette, and that day it was my turn. He told me of something that had happened on his last trip to visit his Lafayette, Louisiana newspaper. I don't recall who was with him on the trip, but the part he told me about was his visit to some dive in nearby New Orleans. He said he had gone there with the manager of his Lafayette paper, and as they sat in this bar, a young woman came around wearing only a fur coat. For $1, she would stand in front of your table and open the coat wide. So Morgan said, "I took a dollar out of my pocket and gave it to her." Saying that to me, he hung up. It was a typical Murphy conversation. Later, when I recounted this episode to the other Murphy executives, they were just as dumbfounded as I had been to discover Morgan had a dollar in his pocket. This was the first direct evidence that he carried any money. On trips, we executives paid the cabs, bought the newspapers, paid the hotel rooms, meals, and the rest. That was our job, and we happily did it. Morgan was always appreciative of our doing so. Of course, not all trips were by train or plane to distant points. Sometimes he wished to visit his newspaper and radio stations in nearby Minnesota or Wisconsin cities. Then we would go by car. In the earlier years, he had a big Cadillac with a sliding glass partition between the front and back seats. The chauffeur would drive the car while Morgan and I would sit in back, and we could discuss business without the chauffeur hearing us. If the trip straddled the lunch hour, Morgan would bring along a box lunch, and we would happily munch sandwiches as we rode along. In latter years, the chauffeur disappeared, and one of us drove the car. I never knew why the chauffeur was disposed of. It was not for lack of money. There must have been another reason, but one never asked questions. Early on, I learned of his philosophy, and I stored these bits of philosophy in my memory, and I lived by them. He would tell me something once, and I had better remember. Those around me with poor memories fell by the wayside and were no longer members of his organization. I may not have been smart, but I did have a memory of a sort anyway. One time, he and I were in his chauffeur-driven car on the way to his Hibbing radio station, discussing problems in connection with the soon-to-be Virginia radio station. And he dropped this remark, "Be like the swan on the pond. Be calm and serene on the surface, but be paddling like hell underneath." I soon learned the paddling like hell underneath part. That was my job, and you notice I stayed with him for many years after. Little interesting things happened. One time, Morgan called in his financial advisor, Norman Postles, and asked Norman to quietly find out who owned a piece of land in downtown Superior Morgan had had his eye on for some time, wondering why the owner did not build on it. He wanted that piece of land, but to inquire quietly, as if the owner knew Morgan was interested, that would, of course, quadruple the selling price. Norman did investigate and came back to Morgan laughing. Search of the record showed Morgan Murphy was himself the owner of that property and had been for many years. He had just forgotten he owned it. As his eyesight dimmed, it was my job to go through each week's issue of Broadcasting Magazine and select the broadcast news stories therein which would be of interest to him. After I made my selection, I would call his secretary Lois and read off the page and paragraph. I suppose she then went in his office and read these stories to him. I imagine the same practice was followed by his newspaper people, who scanned the pages of the Wall Street Journal and other magazines and papers. I never asked, and never found out. All this was taken care of by his longtime, faithful secretary, Lois Westman, who ran his office so expertly and efficiently, he could be away from his office for long periods of time knowing everything would be taken care of exactly as he wished. She was a real jewel in the Murphy organization. And it was Lois who sat in Morgan's office at every stockholders meeting, pen in hand, taking notes. I never attended these stockholder meetings, but word came back to me from other Murphy executives that these stockholder meetings were lonesome affairs, just Morgan and Lois. Rarely did any stockholders show up. These were minority stockholders anyway, and they knew their few votes would have no influence whatsoever in running the corporation. And besides, Morgan ran all his corporations so efficiently and profitably they could find no fault with his leadership. Other than Morgan, all stockholders of his many corporations were definitely minority stockholders. Morgan would never be in any corporation unless he owned 51% or more of the stock. It seems every town he had a newspaper in and or a radio TV station, the two would have separate corporate names and would be separate corporations. When he went into a new town with newspaper or radio TV, he would invite some prominent local person to have 5 or 10% of the stock in that corporation. Then he would have some local person as errand boy to serve the interest of that corporation in that community. The system worked well, and everyone was happy. These local stockholders, of course, would understand that their stock was at the same time worthless and, on the other hand, of great value. This might sound confusing until you realize none of his corporations ever paid any dividends, as all the money earned was plowed back into the corporation or loaned to another of his corporations. So, if you held stock in a corporation that never paid dividends, you had, in effect, worthless stock, as you could not sell it. Who would want it? Who would buy stock that never paid dividends? But there might come a time when your stock was of great value, and that would be the time when the corporation was sold. Then, you got your share. Only problem here was Morgan rarely, if ever, sold one of his corporations, so there you sat with worthless stock. This certainly was true in the early years, but I believe in later years, after I left his organization, he did sell corporations and a profit did come your way. Morgan always built up his companies. I was aware of that as I built and rebuilt his radio and TV stations. There was always money available for improving a facility. He was good for the industry. But as his blindness increased and the world of darkness pressed in on him, he was less and less happy. For a man of such vigor and industrial vision to have darkness descend on him was so cruel and so wrong. Then came the day when he heard of a world-renowned specialist who had an office in the Bellevue Hospital in Baltimore. He wrangled an appointment with this doctor, but that appointment was 6 months off. The time did go by, and Morgan and I traveled first to Washington and then up to Baltimore, being there at the 2 o'clock appointment time. I sat in the waiting room for a long hour and a half. Then Morgan came out, and together we got in a cab and went to the train station. Morgan said not a word, and of course I asked no questions. One never asked questions. It was when we were on the train and headed back to Washington that he spoke for the first time. He said, "There is no hope." And he fell silent again for the entire trip back to Washington. We talked about other things, but I knew from his speech and behavior he was crushed. He knew he was doomed to darkness. It was from others I learned about his particular kind of blindness, a blindness that began in childhood. The way I heard it was that his eyes had aged prematurely. At the age of 20, he had the eyes of a 60-year-old man. When this Bellevue doctor examined him, he had the eyes of a 150-year-old man. There was no way to reverse this process. Years later, I communicated with a research lab in Chicago. They were developing a new process where the blind could wear a tiny TV camera on their head, which would be connected to electrodes in the brain. But Morgan was not interested. He said no one was going to plant electrodes in his brain, so I stopped corresponding with the Chicago people, and I've heard nothing about the process since. I suppose it never got off the ground. My health failed. working under pressure for Morgan and moonlighting for other stations on the side, working all the time, finally got to me at the age of 45. I lost weight, big pain insides, could not sleep at night. I went to our family doctor, Dr. Erberg, and he told me to get out of that company. "I know that company," he said. "He told me to go to a small town, work with my hands a lot, and live entirely differently." I took his advice and went to Ely. Soon after that, our doctor died of overwork, and we had to get another doctor. But I went to Morgan and told him I had to leave, and he said he understood. He had had a third of his stomach removed due to ulcers brought on by tension and overwork, as he drove himself as hard as he drove the rest of us. So, to Ely I went, with his blessing. But I never really stopped working for him. In the 17 or so years following, I ran errands for him. He would call me up and say he was thinking of buying a TV cable system in San Francisco, or a TV station in North Dakota or Michigan, or a TV station somewhere else. Would I go and look at the property and tell him what I thought of it? I would drop what I was doing and travel to this place, look at it, and then go to Morgan's office and give him my opinion. Between times, I would visit him and have lunch with him at the Gitchigami Club in Duluth. I never did live in Duluth after 1954, and it was only when I visited Duluth Superior that I had lunch with him. I would get him at his office in Superior late morning, take him to lunch in Duluth, and then take him back to his office. Then I would go back to Duluth. This process would shoot my whole day, and I did not do it too often. Now I wish I had done it oftener, but hindsight is so crystal clear, while foresight is so hazy. I was sitting in our living room in Brainerd when the call came from Lois that evening. It was February 7th, 1971. Morgan had died of a heart attack in the hospital hours before. Would I come over and be pallbearer? Of course I would. The shock was considerable. I had not even known he had been ill, and I guess the illness had been very brief. June and I hurried to Superior and found him and his family in a funeral home there. Also, there were executives from his far-flung newspaper, radio, and TV empire, all of whom I knew. However, I was the only friend pallbearer, as all others were his executives. Of course, I really had never stopped working for him, so I guess I was still one of his executives. That large Catholic cathedral was packed, but mostly by sightseers, as actually very few people knew him. We pallbearers carried that heavy casket down the aisle and put it in the hearse. As the funeral procession wove its way along Superior streets, I was surprised by the large number of Superior policemen blocking the intersections, keeping traffic from our path. An almost unknown man being carried past throngs of people to a lonely hillside grave. We left him by the grave and went away. After the funeral, we went to Roy Westman's home in Superior, who was then the manager of Morgan's Superior paper. While the pallbearers, wives, and various friends gathered upstairs to visit and to eat a bit, I wandered downstairs and found Lois sitting alone by the fireplace. She was crying. And as we sat and talked, she told me something I did not know. She said that on those times when I had called ahead saying I would be in town and would have lunch with him, Morgan would walk around the rest of the day saying, "Charlie is coming to town, and we're going to have lunch." And he would keep on saying it up to the time I came. This was the first indication I had that my visits meant much to him. Now, too late, much too late, I found out how important these lunches were. I didn't think they were important, but they were to him. And isn't that the way? We go through life failing to notice little things we do are so important to others. It should always pause to make us think and examine our way of life. Lois's tears that day brought this home to me.